especially when I had friends who mom and dad had separated or divorced, and they never saw their dad. They were living with their mom or whatever, and just I just felt so bad, you know, because I had something that I did, you took for granted when you're a kid, right? You don't think about it. When you're 14, 15 years old, you have a godly father there every day. Then I started finding out that, you know, some of my friends didn't have a dad, and I realized what I did have. What a blessing. Page 249 in your story. If you need a book, before you guys come, does anybody need a book? Anybody that didn't bring it with them or didn't get a copy of it? All right. Great. Thank you. Ushers are just walking in. But page 249 is where we're going to be this week, chapter 18. So read chapter 19 of the story for next week. We've done this a couple of times since we started the series. Anybody have any questions? Maybe about this chapter or the chapters we've already studied. Maybe something that maybe we've read and it just impacted you. But maybe a comment. Maybe just a praise that you have as you've read through the story. Again, some of the men that we talked to at our deacons meeting, they're just saying, it's just so neat to see this. And we've been evaluating it every month just to make sure. We always evaluate the church ministry as a board. And this is one of the things that we've been really impressed with. Is this the way it's written? But the things that we're learning. Any comments, any questions, anything about the story at all? You're all reading it? I hope so. Yeah, we should Larry and Steve and Joe. Yeah. Yeah. The names are a little bit more difficult. The towns, they're fun to pronounce too. So that's a comment. We'll ask God why he didn't make names easier. Bill. Right. Yeah, very good. I've enjoyed it. And we just had some friends down from Corning yesterday, and he's in the church that gave us all this material. And I was saying to Tom, I said, I haven't mentioned this to you guys or the board, but I might consider doing this again in like two or three years. Come back and do this because it's not no problem reading it. But I can tell you there's so many different ways you could go on in doing a sermon. So you could probably do this story seven or eight times and never repeat. Well, you'd repeat yourself in some ways, but there's so much to go on. In this chapter, for instance, so many different ways you could go with it. So I think maybe possibly two or three years, if the Lord doesn't come back. We were talking about that, too, in the world today and country we live in. Wouldn't it be great that we didn't have to meet next Sunday, that the Lord will be back, and we'd be in his presence? Perhaps that'll happen before we ever get around to doing it in two or three years. But if we're still here, that remains a possibility of doing that. But as we've looked at the story of the last two or three weeks, we've seen the people of Israel and Judah. That's some of the comments that people have made. They didn't realize that Israel was wiped out to the extent that it was, that the 10 northern tribes are no longer around. So the 10 northern tribes made up Israel. They're no longer present. They were wiped out by Assyria. And Judah has followed right along with that. The two southern tribes continued right on in the sin. Matter of fact, we said that God called it idolatry, but he referred to them as having adulterous hearts. Hearts that went after the things of the world. And having witnessed their sisters and brothers up in the north, Israel being destroyed by Assyria, you would think that Judah would have learned its lesson. But they didn't. They continued on steadfastly in sin and rebellion and idolatry. And we said it's become a very steep, fast, and slippery slope for this nation that really was called the people of God, God's chosen people. And you think back to where they started. The people were wrong for asking for a king to begin with. God told them that. God told them some of the consequences that would occur if they did, in fact, choose a king over following and honoring him. So they started off, and Saul came in. And Saul had some personal issues, a lot of poor self-image, a lot of jealousy and anger and rage. And he did some good things, but he was a poor king. Then David came along, and David is a man after God's own heart. And imagine having that said. What hope is there for us that a man who murdered, a man who committed adultery, a man who was a terrible father in many ways, still was considered a man after God's own heart? So there's grace extended there. So David was the king that all the rest of the kings would be measured against. He wasn't like David, as they say about many. He didn't follow my ways as David had done. So then Solomon came in, and Solomon started off well, the wisest man in all the world, and started off well, but it said that his 1,000 wives, as he got older, turned his heart to idol worship, to worshiping the gods of these foreign women. And when Solomon died, his son came in, and that led to the divided kingdom. Well, Israel lasted about 200 years before Assyria wiped them out after they chose a king. Judah lasted about another 136 years after Israel was captive, before Babylon came in. And I have in your notes, Babylon took them in three different stages. And that's kind of in your, part of it's in your, on page 249 there. Daniel exiled to Babylon. In 605, the Babylonians came in and they took the very educated, the very wealthy, and those who were considered rulers and leaders of the nation. They took them captive. 8 years later, in 597, they took the workers and the laborers, and they needed work done, so they came in and took these people. And then in 586, what led to the destruction of Jerusalem, they destroyed the temple. They burned Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and taking most of the rest of the people, they left a handful of people still there, but took most of the rest of the people captive. And just think how painful it would have been to be a devoted follower of Christ. There weren't many, but if you were a follower of Christ at that point, to remember where your nation was, to you know the history. The Israelites, you know, studied it and read it, and they knew their history far better than what we even do reading it. They were educated people, and they knew that God had brought them out of Egypt. They knew that God had fought with them every step of the way through the inheritance of the promised land, and how God had blessed them and how God had led them. And the property that they had was theirs because God gave it to them. And now being removed from that, the chosen nation of God was being held captive and led away to Babylon. So far in the story, we've seen men and women who've made some very difficult choices and that have cost them very dearly in their lives. They made choices that led sometimes to death when a wrong choice would have been much easier to do. And I just put down a few to think of them, but think about Joseph. Joseph very easily could have given in when Potiphar's wife said, "Sleep with me." No one else was around. She wanted him, and she was beautiful. So as a man, in his mind, he probably thought, "I can get away with this. I can have this free sex that no one will know about. And, you know, who's to see?" He chose not to do that, and it led to imprisonment. And then when he was made second in command, he was given control of everything, all the money, all the grains, everything. He could have easily pocketed some money. No one would have known. He wasn't accountable to anyone. But we see he was always a man who followed God's heart. Think about Moses. Moses was a man who could have rejected God's will and said, "I'm not going to lead these people." He tried to do that. But one of the things we said is, aren't you, I'm sure Israel was, but aren't you glad that God and Moses never got angry on the same day? Because there were times when Moses was so frustrated with the people and he said, "Oh, I can't take this anymore." And God said, "No, I want you to lead them. They're still my people." And then you read a couple chapters later that God said, "Moses, I'm going to wipe these people out. I'm sick of them. I'm going to start over with you. I'm going to destroy every man and woman, and I'm going to start a new nation with you." And Moses will say, "God, don't do that, because if you do, then all the people around us will blame you and laugh at you." So if God and Moses had ever gotten angry together, Israel would have been wiped out long before they were when Assyria took them. But there was times when Moses could have made some wrong choices. You think about David. David could have easily killed Saul. Several times he had the opportunity to do that, and several times his men said, "Do it. He's right here, David. All you had to do," remember, he reached out and cut off a part of his robe. He could have easily stabbed him, but he didn't. There were times that David made some wrong choices, but we see him often, even when people were encouraging him to do wrong, he did what was right. We didn't look at Job in the story, Well, you know the story of Job. Job, just again, put yourself in his place. He's at home, and his kids were having a party together, and groups like a wave of servants come to him and said, "Hey, all your livestock were wiped out. All your grains were wiped out. Your house, the house that your kids were meeting and partying in, was blown down, and all your kids are dead." And Job said, "Bless his name, of the Lord. He's given, he's taken away." And then his wife comes along and says, "Job, why don't you just curse God and die? Don't hold on to your integrity. Don't be a fool. God's doing this to you." And it said, "Can we receive good and not bad? Blessed be the name of the Lord." And it said, in all that, Job did not sin. I want you to understand, throughout Scripture, we see people who have the opportunity to do what's wrong, but they chose to do what's right. And we face that same temptation today, don't we? People say to us, "Everyone else is doing it. Lighten up." Have you ever had anybody tell you that? Lighten up. No one else cares. Why should you? Or, "No one's going to see. You can get away with it. Just do it." You remember Flip Wilson? Some of you who are old enough to remember this, some of you might not. But what was Flip Wilson's? Who made Flip Wilson do it? The devil, right? Remember Flip Wilson? "The devil made me do it." And that was a great laugh, and it was a lot of fun. But that's rationalized in many people's lives today, isn't it? Because we do have two voices. One is Satan. One's using our own flesh to say that. But we have our own flesh and Satan saying, "Go ahead and do it. No one's going to know. No one's going to care. Just lighten up. Don't be the sourpuss in the crowd. Have fun. Have a good time." But there's another voice that speaks to us and says, "Choose my way." And that's the voice that spoke to David and to Moses and to Job and to Joseph when he was in prison. And it's the voice that spoke to the characters that we're going to look at today in chapter 18 of Daniel. Numerous characters. I said you could have gone a lot of different ways in this chapter. Numerous characters we could have looked at. Most people think that Daniel's the star because it's called the Book of Daniel. I'm not so sure he's really the main character. But he's certainly one of them. We're going to look at five characters today. We're going to look at the three men who were with Daniel. We're going to look at Daniel, and we're also going to look at Nebuchadnezzar. And I want you to understand that those four, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, would have gone in that first stage in 605. They would have been captured. They were highly educated men, and they would have gone into Babylon in that first captivity. So we're going to look at 3 points this morning. Oops. Oh, okay. I forgot. I had that up there. In this chapter, I forgot I did have this one up there. I know you can't read it, but I'm going to go to you. I'll explain it in a minute. In this chapter, we're going to look at compare these five men, and four of them really were very humble men. One of them was full of pride. This is called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory. I read about this a few years ago and wasn't sure, and I knew that there was this inventory out, but I didn't know how real it was or if it was really a genuine thing. So I looked at it, I studied it, and I got it off Google. You can get it, and there's 40 questions, and I know you can't read them, so I'm just going to read some of these to you. But this is to tell whether you'll be a good leader, and they really use this quite often. Are you a selfish person? Are you one who gives to others? But it's called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, and I want to tell you, Nebuchadnezzar would have scored off the charts in this. The other four men, they would have been fine. But here's some of the questions. Over here it says, I have a natural talent for influencing people. I'm not good at influencing people. Modesty doesn't become me. That's, you have to answer that honestly. I am essentially a modest person. I would do almost anything on a dare. I tend to be a fairly cautious person. Down here, I will be a success. I'm not too concerned about success. I am better, or I am no better or worse than most people. I think I am a special person. I see myself as a good leader. If I rule the world, it would be a better place. And you're supposed to answer those things. And it's 40 questions, and you could do it right online, and it'll give you whether you're a narcissistic person. Again, a narcissistic person is a person who's just full of themselves. They love their own body. They love themselves. They love everything about them. And I want you to understand, Nebuchadnezzar, the third person we're going to look at this morning, and under point number 3, would have scored off the charts with this. He was full of himself. The other four men, Very humble. And that's what we're going to look at this morning. Number one is in the furnace. In the furnace. The first three characters, and I have them in your notes, there are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I can never, even when I was a kid, I read the names and I'd understand it. But we call the book of Daniel, Daniel, and that's how we refer to Daniel. But we refer to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as their given names. They were really Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And I don't know why we don't call them their Jewish names, but we change that. We know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But we know that they were very educated men, and they spent 3 years learning all the Babylonian ways, doing all the study. And people said they would have come out of that study and out of that teaching knowing more about Babylon and its history and its ways than most Babylonians would. I think it would be comparing it to where we are today. Have you ever talked to someone who has taken, has become an American citizen? They weren't born here, but they became an American citizen. We have some friends, as a matter of fact, a girl that I taught in China named Jessica. Her American name is Jessica. And she married a guy named Lloyd. He's an Indian, from India. And they met down at in the university, where'd they go? Baylor University. We were just together with them. We get together with as family now. We were together with them at Thanksgiving. Neither one of them are Christians, so we're praying that through just being around all our family and just talking to them and praying with them that both of them will come to Christ. But my niece, Rob's daughter, Jennifer, was hosting the Thanksgiving dinner this year, and Lloyd is now an American citizen. He started talking about things in American history. And I remember my niece sitting there saying, I didn't know that. And he goes, oh, yeah, yeah. And he brought up this other date, and Jennifer goes, what in the world is that? And he goes, oh, this is this and this. And it's amazing, people who weren't born and raised here, but they study for that test, they know far more American history than what the average American, probably not the average American, probably more than 95% of us would know about American history. And that's, they put us to shame. And it's kind of embarrassing to have an Indian man bring up dates and tell me about what happened in our own country and me not remember it. Not that I was there, mind you, but to hear the history, I knew those dates. I studied them. I just don't remember them. But these people who come in and learn it to be an American citizen, they remember it. And that's what would have happened with these three. They would have come out and they would have known all the stuff that went on in Babylon. And we're told in their preparation, in this three-year preparation, that they were given special food, probably steak, probably wine, maybe some pork, but good food. And they realized, we can't eat that because it's going to defile us. It would go against what God has told us about ourselves. And I thought, and I knew this story, but as I was just rereading it this week, what in sharp contrast were these three men, or these four men, if you think about Daniel, to the rest of the people of Israel and Judah? Because the people of Israel and Judah, they didn't give a rip about defiling themselves, did they? They were serving other gods. They were guilty of idol worship. And God said, you have adulterous hearts. Here, I want to point it out to you. Please change. And they continued on. They just continued to defile themselves, to sin against God, and not care about what people thought of them or what God even thought about them. Yet these three, they committed, along with Daniel, not to do anything against God's way. If you turn to page 250 in the Bible, or in the story, it says this: Nebuchadnezzar brought them in after they completed their 3 years of training. Well, back up a little bit. The guy who was giving their food didn't want to just give them vegetables and water, because that's what these men chose. They said, we'll just eat vegetables and just give us some water to drink. My wife could live on that. She always said she could be a vegetarian. If I didn't have rolls and meat, I would die. So I don't know what I would have done here, but these guys came out, and then the man who brought them their food, he said, test us for 10 days. And it said they were fatter and healthier than all the rest of the people who ate the king's food. And Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel were healthier. And when Nebuchadnezzar questioned them at the end on page 250, it says he found them to be 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. In his whole kingdom. Those are the people who have been trained years before. Nebuchadnezzar found these four men to be 10 times better. And we know the story well. We know what happens here, whether we read the chapter or not. Nebuchadnezzar was filled with pride, and he built this image of gold that was 90 by 90 and or 90 by 9. And he said, everybody must bow down to this image like me. It's created to look like me, and I want everyone, when the music plays, you've got to bow down. Imagine the joy of the kingdom. The people were excited because just like when Moses led them out of Egypt, remember they were in the wilderness for a short time, and they were kind of getting confused, and Aaron made the golden calves. There's something about seeing something, whether it's a real God or not. There's something about seeing something that they could worship. So the people of Babylon were excited. They had this image that's huge, and they could worship it. And Nebuchadnezzar must have been excited too because they were worshiping him. So joy in the kingdom until Nebuchadnezzar receives word that the three guys, three of these Jewish people, refuse to listen to you. They're not bowing down. And we don't know where Daniel was at this point. I'm sure Daniel wasn't bowing down either, but his name's not mentioned. But word comes back to Nebuchadnezzar that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the ones that are 10 times better than the rest of us, are not listening to your command. They're not bowing down. So Nebuchadnezzar was furious, it says. He was angry. So he calls them in. He says, listen, is this true that that you're not bowing down? I'm going to give you a second chance. I'm going to give you another opportunity. Perhaps you didn't understand my directive here. Perhaps you didn't understand what I've told you to do. When you hear the music play, while I'm here in front of you, when you hear the music play, just go ahead and bow down and all will be forgiven. And I love their words. They say the God that we're able to serve will deliver. See, what Nebuchadnezzar said is, I'm going to give you a second opportunity, but if you don't do it, here's what's going to happen. You're going to burn in the furnace. And then he asked this question. He said, what God could deliver you from my hands? And their response is amazing. The God we serve is able to deliver us. But even if he does not, we will not serve your gods or worship this image of gold. Can you imagine doing that? I don't know if you can think about what that means or not. To say, God is going to deliver me. He's able to. And our question is, who do I worship? Who do I worship? Now, I've thought about their statement here. Some people were saying that they're making kind of a very wishy-washy statement. God is able to deliver us, but if he doesn't, he can't. Is that statement kind of wishy-washy? Is he weak? Are they giving God an out? Are they saying, we believe God can deliver us. He probably won't. But if he doesn't, we're still going to die knowing that he's God. That's not what they're saying at all. What they're saying here is, we know God can deliver us. But I'm telling you, it's better for me to die serving the God in heaven than it is to bow down and worship you. God will deliver us, but if he doesn't, our faith hasn't changed. It's not a statement of weakness at all. But so the question we need to ask ourselves is, who do I worship in my life? And over the last couple of weeks, we didn't say anything last week, but gave you a bunch of questions to ask. Where do I spend my money? Where do I go to for happiness? Where do I go to for comfort? What brings me joy? What brings me peace? I think there were 10 questions that we asked ourselves, and we said we do have modern day idols. Because we looked oftentimes to the world for our peace. We look oftentimes to the world for our relief, for our comfort, for our encouragement. And God's often the last place that we turn. But we see these men who are following after Jehovah, and they said, if he delivers us, fine, we love him. If he chooses not to, we're going to die loving him. Some of us have been praying for this woman, Miriam Ibrahim, 26-year-old Christian. How many have seen her on the news? All right, she's a believer being held. I think it's in Iran. She's a Sudanese woman. The man that she's married to is a Christian. Miriam is a born-again Christian. She was taken captive about 3 months ago. She was 7 months pregnant. Her and her 20-month-old son were put in prison. And they said, Miriam, you deny your faith, deny Christianity because it's against the law, or you're going to be hanged. She had her baby about 3 weeks ago. So the baby is still in prison with her. Her 20-month-old son is still in prison with her, and she's waiting to be hanged for being a Christian. Now, we saw last night on Fox News they had Pastor Saeed is another believer that's being held. But John Kerry is supposedly now working to get her release. It's been 3 months. You know, we'll trade five prisoners to get a Marine who abandoned his people to come home, but let a Christian woman take a stand and our country won't do anything. Makes me angry, but we pray for her. But she's given that same choice that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were given. Bow down to me and worship and deny your God or you're going to die. Here's a woman who's had 3 months to deny being a Christian, and she refuses. We need to pray for her. Matter of fact, let's just pause right now. If I could have a couple people just pray for Miriam's release, and then also Pastor Saeed is a pastor who's being held, an American pastor, American wife, but he's being held, medical privileges being withheld from him. He was put in the hospital to get some treatment, and they put him back in prison now with no medical stuff, and they said he's been beaten so bad that he needs medicine. So Pastor Saeed and Miriam, if I just had a couple people just right now, just pray for them. Amen. Again, maybe that verse is encouraging her that we just read. If God chooses, he can deliver me, but I'm not going to deny my faith. If he doesn't deliver me, I'm still going to trust him. Continue to pray for her now that you've seen her face and you know the story. Pray for our persecuted Christians and brothers and sisters around the world. Point number two. We looked at in the furnace. Point number two is in the lion's den. And we see now that Daniel, if we were going to call him his given name, it would be Belteshazzar. That's the name that the Babylonians gave to Daniel. But Daniel now is standing alone in his leadership. The new king, Darius, was caught in a moment. He's not a bad king. He was not nearly as narcissistic as Nebuchadnezzar had been. He doesn't seem like he's on the same high opinion of himself. But in a moment, I'd say of weakness, his fellow leaders come to him and say, listen, Darius, you're a great king. Why don't you make a decree that no one can be prayed to other than you? And he signed that. And it's just interesting to think about that. And we're told in the story that these men did that because they wanted to capture Daniel in something. He was such a good man that his fellow leaders were upset about him. And I asked here, what was it that bothered his leaders, the other men, the other captains and stuff in the guard and other leaders in the nation, what bothered them so much about Daniel? It wasn't that he preached. It wasn't that he stood up in the pulpits and pounded his hand. It wasn't that he went up and grabbed people and said, you need to trust in Jehovah. It wasn't his words, but it was his life. You probably all heard the story of probably 25 or 30 years ago, Billy Graham was playing golf with a group of other guys, and one guy was just really irate. By the second or third hole, he was just so mad, and the guy that was playing with him was his friend, and he said, what is your problem today? I've never seen you. You've hit some bad shots. He goes, it's Billy Graham. He's just preaching at me all the time, and he says, Billy Graham hasn't said a word. He goes, no, he hasn't said anything, but I know how he lives. And this golfer just couldn't get out, couldn't let the words fly that he normally would. And it wasn't that Billy Graham was preaching at him. It wasn't that Billy Graham was holding a crusade there on the golf course. It was that Billy Graham's life ministered so much to this man that he knew that he couldn't do some of the things that he normally did. That's what we see here in the life of Daniel. In page 257 in the story is what tells you that. It says his life, the things that he did, they could catch him in the things of his God, the way that he worshiped. And we're told here that Darius passes this law that no one could pray to any other idol or god other than him. And Daniel knew that that law had been passed. And I love this. It says in Daniel 6:10, Daniel, when he knew the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had opened windows toward Jerusalem, and he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God. And I underline this in my Bible, as he had been doing previously. Nothing changed for Daniel. He wasn't saying, well, I'm going to do something just to be in your face. I'm going to show you that I'm a good godly man. I'm going to do this just to show you that I'm a good guy and to prove you wrong. It said nothing changed for Daniel. He just continued worshiping the God that he'd always worshiped. But nothing changed because he'd heard this law had been passed either. And because the law had been stamped with Darius' own hand, the law of the Medes and Persians, it couldn't be revoked. And the punishment was to be put in the lion's den. Anyone who did that was going to be cast in the lion's den. And the reason I believe that Darius was caught in a weak moment is, as you know this story pretty well, Darius spent the whole night awake praying that Daniel would be okay. He got up early the next morning and he ran to the lion's den. There's a picture on our water fountain. I don't know who put that out there, but it's a picture of Daniel in the lion's den, and there's people up looking in the window, and the lions are just kind of sitting there, laying there, looking at Daniel and not even licking their chops. But Daniel made it through, and Darius ran out the next morning and came out and he said, Daniel, has your God delivered you? See, as soon as Darius realized that Daniel, one of his prized leaders, was going to be put in the lion's den, it bothered Darius. It hurt him. It grieved him. But Darius was impacted through the God of Daniel. And Daniel says, my God has delivered me. Shut the mouths of the lions. So they brought Daniel out. You remember the story? It says, Darius said, everyone who's accused Daniel, just throw them in the lion's den. Them and their family, their wives and their kids, throw them in. And what happened? Had the lions been so well fed before that Daniel didn't need to worry? No, it says before their bodies even hit the bottom of the ground, got down to the bottom of the den, the lions broke every bone in their body. Certainly it was God that protected Daniel. And Daniel could have had the opportunity to say, man, I'm brought out. He said, I am such a good animal person. They should call me Dr. Doolittle. I just sat and talked to those lions. They didn't bother me. It was because of my winsome personality. I'm just such a good person that God protected me. He didn't say that. He gave God complete credit for protecting him, for keeping him safe through that entire evening. Earlier in the book of Daniel, we see another event involving Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and the dream really bothered him, so he called in all the magicians and said, I want you to tell me my dream and then interpret it for me. And you remember that story, and all of them were saying, we can't. You tell us the dream, we might be able to interpret it. And Nebuchadnezzar said, I know your tricks. I want you to tell me what I dreamt and then explain it to me. And they said, we can't do it. No one can do it. There's never been asked of anyone to ever have something like this done. And Nebuchadnezzar got angry. Nebuchadnezzar was always mad. He was always furious, and he was always thinking of himself. He said, I'm so mad, I just want everybody wiped out. I want you to kill everybody. So they went to the cell to kill Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. And Daniel said, you know, what's so angry? What's got the king so angry? And they said, because he's had this dream. And Daniel said, I want you to know, I can do that. Take me to the king. So he takes him to the king, and on page 252 in the story, it says, Nebuchadnezzar said, are you able to interpret this dream for me? I've been so anxious to have someone do it. And Daniel said this, and again, some of us would have been tempted to say, yes, I can tell you now, right now, because I have such a great relationship with God, and I am such a man or a woman of God, I can do this. Daniel said, I can't. I'm not about to do this, but he said, but there is a God in heaven. who reveals mysteries. And when Daniel successfully described the dream and interpreted the meaning of it, Nebuchadnezzar said on page 253, he says, "Surely your God is the God of gods." If you look at that on page 253, it says, "Surely your God," G-O-D, big G, "is the God of little g, O-D-S. Your God is the God of gods." Nowhere do we see Daniel being filled with pride or self-awareness and self-promotion, self-success. But he was always yielded to the Lord. And the question I think we need to ask ourselves as we study this, being thrown in the lion's den, is how important is my prayer life to me? How important is my prayer life to me? How many of us would be willing to die for being a man or woman of prayer? None of us are ever threatened by that. But yet, how many of us pray on a regular basis? How many of us pray for not just the big things in our lives? We're pretty good about that. But how many of us pray for the small things? How many of us would have thought of praying? Or how many have ever prayed for Miriam when you've seen her on TV or Pastor Saeed? How many of you just pause during the day when someone shares a prayer request with you and say, "I'm just going to pray for it right now"? I do that because I write stuff down because I forget if I don't. And when someone shares something, I try to pause right away and just say, "God, I hope to remember this a little bit later, but right now just work in this situation." We need to be people of prayer. And how important is our prayer life to us? I want you to answer that to yourself. It's a serious question. It was important enough to Daniel that he was willing to die. He was willing to lay down his life because prayer and fellowship and time talking to God was that important to him. And then point number three is in the wilderness. We've been in the furnace. We've been in the lion's den. Now we're going to look at the one who would have scored the highest on this narcissistic inventory. He thought very highly of himself, promoted himself quite regularly. He had that 90 by 9 foot statue made of himself. And because of his pride, he was driven from being around mankind. When Daniel was given the meaning of that vision, that dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, Daniel says, "I wish, King, that this applied to someone else. I wish this wasn't about to be fulfilled in your life. But here it is." And he told him the story. He told him, "Here's what's going to happen. You're a man that's full of pride and arrogance. You're about to be driven for a year away from the palace, away from man. You're going to live like a beast in the wilderness." And that's what happened. And we're told that Nebuchadnezzar certainly happened. He was walking around in his palace normally, and suddenly he was driven out. And it says his hair grew real long. His nails grew like an eagle's talon, and he was driven out. And then after the end of the year, this is what Nebuchadnezzar says in Daniel chapter 4. It's up here in your notes, but Daniel chapter 4, verses 30 to 33, it says, "The king reflected and said, is this not Babylon the great, which I myself have made a residence by the power of God and by the glory of my majesty?" While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice from heaven came saying, "King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you. And you will be driven from mankind, and your dwelling place will be among the beasts of the field. You will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestowed on it whomever he wishes." Immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind. He began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, and his hair grew like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. I put the wrong verse up here, but that's going to be in just a moment. I meant to put this one up. This was when he was driven out, all right? And we ask ourselves, why what's up here? Why did that happen? Why was he driven away from mankind? God says to him, because of verse 30, he says it because of pride and arrogance. Yet after living 7 years in the jungle, in the wilderness like an animal, it says God brought grace to Nebuchadnezzar, and he allowed him to return home, and he allowed him to to take up again a place where he once was, and he began worshiping God. Amazing. And I want you to think about this. I was just talking to my friends yesterday who came from Corning. They went through the story 2 years ago. And I was telling them we were going through Daniel this morning. And I said, one of the things that just impresses me the most here is the impact that godly men can have on a nation. Just a few godly men. Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel. That's the only ones we're told of in the story who really followed Jehovah. But I want you to see the impact that they had on the not only their own nation, but they were held captive. They were held captive in Babylon, and they impacted through God's word and through their prayer life and through their lifestyle. They impacted the entire nation. We read here that Nebuchadnezzar recognized God in the furnace. Remember that? When he saw the three guys walking around, he said, didn't we put three guys in there? How come there's four? One of them looks like an angel. And he when they brought out, they said, man, your God is God. We realized and we said that he recognized, Darius recognized Daniel's God when he spent the night in the lion's den. And then in Daniel chapter 4, this is what I meant to put up, and I put the wrong verses up here. I apologize for that. But Daniel chapter 4, verses 34 to 37. I'm just going to read this to you. This is at the end of the 7 years. And I want you to listen to what happens here, the change of heart. At the end of that time, at the end of 7 years, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Here's a man who was full of pride, full of himself. And God said, because of your arrogance, I'm going to drive you out. He said, then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion, not mine, his dominion is an eternal kingdom. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven, the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, what have you done? Before that, before Nebuchadnezzar went in the wilderness, I'm sure he would have said, I'm in charge here, God. Don't even think about doing anything to me. But he says, no one can say, what have you done? At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne, and I became even greater than before. Does it sound like he's getting prideful again? Well, listen to what he says. He says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify not myself, not my 90x9 image, but I praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and he is just in all his ways. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. That's personal experience, isn't it? Nebuchadnezzar says, those who walk in pride, God will certainly humble. And the question I want us to ask is, how do I respond to correction? When God brings something into my life, how do I respond? Do I continue on in pride? Do I continue on and say, who does God think he is doing this to me? I don't deserve this. I deserve so much better. How do we respond to correction? And the final thought here is, what an awesome God that he wants to be Lord of your life. He wants to show you grace. He wants to show you mercy. He wants to give you power. But I want you to understand, don't ever, ever attempt to rob God of his glory. Don't ever attempt to say, God can't do it without me. God needs me. God has to have me. I am the most important person in the church. I'm the most important person in God's plan. That's what Nebuchadnezzar thought. God humbled him, but then God worked in his heart. Let's be like Nebuchadnezzar, or let's be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel, and say, I don't care if I'm forced to the furnace. I don't care if I'm forced to the lion's den. I'm going to worship God, and my prayer life is going to be concrete. Father, thank you so much for this story in the story. Thank you for your working in the upper story, Lord, in the lives of shutting the lion's mouths, of protecting the men in the furnace, and Lord, even using these four men in powerful ways to speak to kings' hearts, that they saw something different about these guys that they wanted, and how you just changed Nebuchadnezzar so completely from being a man so focused on himself to saying, I'm willing to bow down and praise and worship the God of these men. Lord, thank you for loving us. Thank you for being patient with us. And thank you for desiring to use us. Help us never, Lord, to rob you of your glory. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Let's stand. We're going to sing the All in All. You are my all in all.